I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. I suspect many of us have wrestled with the thought of the appropriate use of force if confronted with a situation when it could be an option. Sometimes it appears to be a no-brainer. Few would argue that our entering World War II was in the bounds of morality. We as a nation look to the bloodshed of the revolution that freed us from the crown as perhaps even more than appropriate, perhaps something close to a holy war. The same might be said for the Civil War that reunified the country and contributed to the end of slavery. Speaking of slavery, though, there never was a massive, successful slave rebellion. So what if at some point in the 18th or 19th century, there took place a finely orchestrated overthrow of plantations across the South by those who had been enslaved for generations? What if it meant that we would now be reading about hundreds of Southern white families slaughtered in their beds or hung in their own barns? Just how would history and religion judge those actions? I don't know, but I suspect we would have been able to clearly separate an event such as that from our War of Independence, or even the slaughter of the Canaanites by the Israelites and other examples of extreme force that are recorded in the Judeo-Christian tradition. An article entitled A Justification for Unrest, Look No Further Than the Bible and the Founding Fathers, by Professors Samuel Boyd and Samira Mehta, appeared on the website The Conversation last spring. It came out right when protests around the country were at a high point. And while the vast majority of protesters were peaceful, there was certainly enough property damage and injury to warrant serious concern. To discuss this topic, we have one of the co-authors of the article with us today. Samuel Boyd is an assistant professor in religious studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. His research focuses on the origins of biblical texts in their historical context, as well as how people have interpreted the Bible over the millennia. He combines history, archaeology, linguistics, and multiple other theoretical lenses to explore why the Bible was written and why people have cared about it so much. So we welcome to Common Threads, Sam Boyd. Hello, Sam.
Hello. So good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. So before we get into the article itself, tell us a little bit about your work. It really does sound fascinating. You sound like the type of person that could probably be on here biweekly. So your focus, obviously, is biblical text. And it says here why people have cared about it so much. And also what's interesting is that you use so many lenses, archaeology, linguistics, et cetera. Tell us a little bit about your training and how you got to where you are right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It really all starts with a childhood obsession with Indiana Jones. Most people, actually a good number of people in the field, would kind of start it with that sense of there's discovery to be had, whether it's archaeological, somebody finds a text, you have to read it. How do you go from, you know, these civilizations that are buried in the ground, you find a piece of evidence that then shapes how you view the Bible, which has been around for millennia. That is a document that hasn't been, you know, sort of buried and under mounds and mounds of dirt to be excavated. It's been sort of passed around and with traditions of interpretation for thousands of years. So the sort of process of discovery. You know, I have a friend and a colleague, Joel Baden, who teaches at Yale, who has this great quote, and I think it's really helpful, where he says about the Bible, there's a sense of familiarity, and it doesn't breed contempt, but the familiarity we have with the Bible tends to breed inattention. We all think we know the stories, and then when you slow down and you read more carefully, it's fascinating to see what pops up. You know, all the unquestioned assumptions that we have lead us to actually, when we examine them, realize that this is a very complicated anthology of text that still has much to teach us about being human in the world, but also allows us to see the ways in which we've at times not used it for modern societies in ways that are actually very appropriate or responsible. So a lot of my research is asking those questions. Where does the Bible come from in its ancient Near Eastern context? And then what does that mean about how we should look at it today? So it's a fun area of research. It keeps me either in or out of trouble, depending on how people look at things. But I you know, absolutely love every day. Really is an adventure when you get to sort of study the Bible and the ancient world the way that I get to.
So obviously, you do study the Bible in original languages. So are there still times when you can look at something in biblical Hebrew and translate it in a way that has never been translated before? Or have the scholars already done all of that? Is that something you have to still be concerned about?
Oh, we are always still piecing together what these words meant in their original context. And part of that is that languages change over time. And this is a big debate in biblical scholarship. To what extent does something like biblical Hebrew change in the earliest writings to the Bible to the latest? And does that influence how we should interpret certain words? And even some books like the Book of Job has notoriously complex, complicated locutions in it, sentences, clauses. There's a famous scholar, Ed Greenstein, who teaches in Israel, and he wrote a wonderful translation of the Book of Job published by Yale University Press. And at the beginning of it, he has this great saying where he says when he teaches the Book of the Psalms, he sort of highlights for students the fact that there may or may not be a connection from one chapter of the Psalms to the next. It's this collection of ancient liturgies in ancient Israel. When he does ancient, when he teaches Proverbs, the same sort of problem is there, except it's like one verse to the next. The Book of Job is even more complicated. It's like one word to the next, figuring how they go together, what they mean. I think because it's assumed, you know, modern Hebrew is spoken, it's a vibrant language, but that's a resurrected language. Ancient Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, there's still a lot we don't know. Word forms, how verbs relate in their sentences. So we're always refining, constantly refining our lenses through which we can say that this passage or this chapter means X, Y, and Z. It doesn't mean we can't know things. We certainly do have much of the Bible, you know, very well translated, very well understood in its linguistic and historical context. I don't want to sort of give the impression that we don't know anything, but there's a lot of work still to be done. You know, there's a whole lot of work still to be done. A lot of my work comes in what's called language contact. So are there words that are borrowed into biblical Hebrew from other cultures? And if so, does that affect how we sort of sense the meaning of this word over time? And one of the things that I think is really important to remember here is a lot of the other related languages to biblical Hebrew that were dominant in the ancient Near East, that were part of the cultures who produced the literature that the biblical authors borrowed, like the flood stories. One of these languages, Akkadian, was a dominant language for, you know, over 1,000 years, well over 1,000 years, in ancient Mesopotamia, sort of earliest attested around 2600 or so BC, last written around 75 or so Common Era. A very widely studied written language for many centuries in the ancient Near East. That language was only deciphered in 1857 Common Era. It was lost and forgotten for, you know, 1800 years. You know, it's only been understood in the modern critical study of the Bible for the better part of 150 years. And it's a treasure trove of hundreds of thousands of tablets written in Akkadian. And this is very relevant for us, trying to figure out what a word means here or there. So we're still figuring it out. You know, we've done a lot. There's a lot that we know. But that's the fun thing about studying the Bible. I oftentimes think of it as the most assumed document in the world. People assume they know the contents. Whether that's true or not is oftentimes up for debate. And people assume that we know everything there is to know about it, and we just don't. And that makes it fun.
Could you do the work you do without speaking modern Hebrew? Do you speak modern Hebrew?
I don't speak it fluently. I can read certain parts of academic articles. I would like to be more conversational in it. But yes, you can actually do a lot of work in biblical Hebrew without knowing modern Hebrew, for the sake of knowing the biblical Hebrew text itself. You know, there are, you know, minor examples where a Hebrew present tense in modern Hebrew, ani kotev, I am writing, I write. In many dialects of ancient biblical Hebrew, that's kind of a nonsensical sentence because the participle doesn't have that present tense form yet. Hmm. So you can understand things about biblical Hebrew without having to know modern Hebrew. That said, there's so much vibrant scholarship being done in at Hebrew University, at Bar Ilan, Tel Aviv, places like that, that knowing enough modern Hebrew to really be in conversation with the incredible scholars who are doing amazing work over there, that's vital. But for understanding the biblical text itself, you can do it without knowing modern Hebrew. And in fact, there's a really interesting, the assumption that modern Hebrew, there is an assumption that knowing modern Hebrew means you can just read the biblical text, which sometimes works out okay. A lot of times doesn't, and it's actually interesting. There is actually a grammar for biblical Hebrew for people who are fluent in modern Hebrew, as though you have to relearn the grammar of this ancient dialect because, you know, it's somewhat analogous, not entirely, but somewhat analogous to things like Old English versus Modern English.
Sure, sure. Latin versus the Romance languages.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. It's fascinating. I always assumed that my friends who were rabbis spoke modern Hebrew as well, and they say, I could not go to Tel Aviv and make a reservation for a room with two beds at a hotel, unless they spoke English.
And, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, modern Hebrew, it's, you know, for those who are interested in sort of languages that are, you know, resuscitated, it's a very interesting example of how languages operate. And it's got a lot of biblical components to it, but, you know, there are rabbinic Hebrew for rabbinic texts like the Mishnah. It's also called Tannaitic Hebrew. There's a big debate as to whether that's a different dialect than biblical Hebrew, or is that biblical Hebrew that's just developed and had a lot of contact with other languages and sort of evolves to this thing. But modern Hebrew is kind of an amalgam of all those things, plus, you know, new words that are coined or borrowed all the time because of new technologies. And so, you know, you might know those rabbinic texts, you might know the biblical texts, but not necessarily be able to get your way around, you know, Jerusalem or Tel Aviv.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Samuel Boyd, and we're talking about his article, A Justification for Unrest, Look No Further Than the Bible and the Founding Fathers. And actually, we haven't been talking about that, but everything else about him is interesting. I thought, well, I've got him here. I might as well ask questions. But let's get to your article right now, because I did find it fascinating, and I think that many people who are hearing us right now will as well. So you talk about violence and unrest. You say that it informs early Christianity. Now, normally, I believe most people think of early Christians as radical pacifists, people who were martyred, did not stand in the way of their martyrdom. Some people even asked for martyrdom. I understand that. So where do we see that violence and unrest? Where did it have its genesis?
I think you do see, I mean, certainly more in, I would say, the broader Jewish matrix, a part of which Christianity in its earliest phases fits. For the better part of the first 100 years, Christianity is a sect of Judaism. The Roman historian Suetonius says that the Emperor Claudius decrees in 49 Common Era to expel all the Jews from Rome because they're debating over the identity of Acrestus. That's probably a reference to Jesus Christ. Christ, by the way, is not his last name. But this is part of the broader Jewish unrest with, you know, being a part of a marginal society and a very poorly invested area of the Roman Empire. And there are parts of the book of, say, Revelation in the Bible that's quite bloody. Now, it's not necessarily a sense of you take swords in your own hand and do what you need to do. There is a debate in Judaism, and again, I think early Christianity takes part of this, as to whether you should take up the sword yourself. This gives rise to the Jewish revolt in 66 to 70 Common Era, or whether it's really God who's going to do that fighting for you. And so there's a very famous Jewish historian at this time, Josephus, who probably had more of the latter view. And so he abandons fighting sometime around 67 Common Era and actually goes to the Roman side, not as necessarily a turncoat. He would later write books defending Judaism. But as somebody who believed that, you know, it's sort of God's will and prerogative to fight for himself, and you see some of that, you know, in the book of Revelation. This is actually, I sort of hearken back to that Will Ferrell movie, Talladega Nights, where they sort of sit around a table and imagine how they like to pray to Jesus. And for the gospel texts, Jesus is, for the most part, you know, presented as a Jewish peasant, peacekeeping. This is not necessarily, you know, different from a lot of other sort of Jewish thought in the society. There was recently a New York Times article, op-ed piece, about how Jesus broke with much of Jewish society, which is actually wrong and incorrect. Some really good scholars, Candida Moss, Amy Jill Levine, Mark Brettler, and Margaret Mitchell, co-authored, I think as of today, a response to that in the Daily Beast that gets it much more historically and theologically correct. And there is a sense in early Christianity where there's a sort of a somewhat of a pacifist strain. I don't think everybody necessarily took that line. But what we know about early martyrs is also a complicated story and narrative. As Candida Moss has written, you know, a lot of those stories are really sort of framed by later authors' concerns. So understanding exactly what was going on in the earliest phases of Christianity and some of these martyr tales is not always an easy historical task. It is the case that you find things like Justin Martyr, speaking of martyrs, second century Christian, who writes a first and second apology, where what he means by apology, of course, is not, oh, I'm so sorry. What he means is, let me give an account for Christianity. And he sort of appeals to Roman officials and authorities to say, hey, don't persecute Christians. We're actually really good citizens. No, we don't do the imperial cult, but you shouldn't persecute us. But that there is still this sort of in the biblical text itself, in the New Testament, you know, you do find Jesus saying, I haven't, you know, come to bring peace, but a sword. You know, alongside parts where Jesus is saying, Peter, put away your sword, after he attempts to cuts off the ear of one of the guards in the Garden of Gethsemane. So I think in the New Testament, you find a multiplicity of views that are somewhat indicative of, I would say, the Jewish culture at the time, of how do we respond to the unrest and social marginalization that we feel around us. Again, it doesn't mean that everybody felt that. They were, certain people who were doing quite well and just fine, but it certainly was the case that not everybody felt that way, which can lead to the type of unrest that we see oftentimes in societies where marginalized communities feel the pressure. And you know, as we say in our article, this is you know, where Martin Luther King Jr. would say, you know, you can't criticize the unrest unless you understand where it comes from.
You know, another interesting thing, you brought up the example of Peter's sword and cutting off the ear. For years, I've wondered, here's somebody who has followed Jesus for 3 years, and he still carries a sword. One would think that if, you know, Jesus says, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. Do you think that might have been in lesson one, three years ago? So clearly there must have been an acceptance.
If we take
that at face value.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, if we take that story at face value.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the tantalizing bits and pieces of, it's hard to look at any part of the Bible and just assume, you know, this is exactly how it was in history. I mean, the contours of history and what we can actually, you know, use to piece together behind the Bible to get a sense of the daily experiences and lives. I mean, I think with something like Peter carrying a sword, I mean, there's also, stories about Jesus's followers who were zealots. And zealotry is actually, you know, Josephus talks about it as, he mentions different, he calls them philosophies for his Greco-Roman audience. But they're really different Jewish sects, like Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes. And there's a fourth sect that's actually was quite violent. And zealots were kind of part of that. There are people who are called the Sicarii, which literally meant daggermen. They would go in, you know, crowded spaces and with a dagger, you know, pierce somebody's side, somebody falls dead, and it causes mass panic. And some people have seen with the Sicarii, maybe something related to Sicarii in Iscariot, as in Judas Iscariot. It's hard, but, and yet these are followers of Jesus. And it's hard, again, to kind of piece together. You have just enough data to be able to say something. But exactly what's going on behind all this, you know, it's not always easy to really sort of figure out. I mean, boy, would it have been incredible to actually have been there and seen it.
Let's go back to the Hebrew Bible for a while. So according to the Bible, in Exodus, the Israelites left with what you would call in your article plunder, possibly silver and gold. And you say that some people would believe that the Israelites felt that that was what was owed them as slaves. So that brings up the moral question, did they deserve to bring that? Is that something that the rabbis have dealt with, have debated over the centuries?
You know, it certainly is the case that early biblical interpreters do look at that example, and you find, you know, certainly in early Christianity, there's a phenomenal scholar of Jewish studies, James Kugel, who wrote this incredible book called Traditions of the Bible. It's thick, published by Harvard University Press. And in there, he has a section on that very narrative of ancient interpreters who took that as the Israelites were given their just wages. They labored for centuries without payment, and by leaving, you know, sometimes called the despoiling, exactly how you want to label it, but by leaving Egypt with silver and gold that are the Egyptians, there are people who, in the ancient interpretation of the Bible, would basically, you know, affiliate that as an act of kind of reparation, to use it modern terms and parlance for it. Now, that's not something that, I mean, there are plenty of modern Christians who would use that and say, yes, there's reparations should happen, you know, in our country, in our context. But there definitely is a strain of ancient Christian, interpretation of seeing this as just wages. And James Kugel documents that quite well in his book. And it's not something that this is a wonderful example, again, of when people read the Bible, I think they kind of go for the greatest hits, but they don't oftentimes read between the lines. And this act of despoiling or plundering or looting or being given gifts, I mean, it's sort of rephrased in a number of ways to deal with the ethical and moral issues in ancient biblical interpretation. But it certainly is there, and it was certainly something that ancient biblical authors who study these texts tried to figure out. And when they use phrases like, well, it was their just wages and just rewards for laboring for hundreds of years, you know, that has been given an analogy with modern day issues of reparations.
Right. But reparations would come through a legal system. They would be legally granted And here we have the possibility, nothing is fact here, but the possibility that this was actually stolen by the Israelites because they deemed it appropriate. They deemed it moral and just wages, right? I mean, that's the catch. That's what would have to be debated.
Exactly. And there are ancient interpreters who view this as, you know, God... there is a strain of ancient biblical interpretation, and you actually find this with a lot of biblical interpretation, because there are morally difficult issues when you read the Bible and look there for patterns for how you should live life, whether it's as an individual or society all the time. I mean, classic example of this is, in Genesis 12 and Genesis 20, when Abraham passes his wife off as his sister, and he lies. You find ancient interpreters like the Genesis Apocryphon, discovering the Dead Sea Scrolls, who actually change and say, well, it's not actually that Abraham was lying. It's that he was doing the best he could under circumstances, and they sort of reframe it. And the same thing with the passage of the plunder or the looting or the gift giving, as some will later understand it in Egypt, where it's not that something, the Israelites are taking this into their own hands. It's that God is sort of giving a kinder disposition towards the Egyptians, and they give it to the Israelites as they leave. There are a number of ways in which this gets sort of wrestled with and reinterpreted over time, in the same way that I think anybody who's looking to understand the Bible in their own context has to do. You can't simply draw a straight line. Classic examples of these, Purim is another one in the book of Esther, chapter 9. Where people, wrestle with, wow, this is a Jewish community who takes, all sorts of goods and kills their enemies. Is that something you can really sort of apply directly, even if we celebrate Purim? It's something that type of reckoning with, we live in a different culture, time, and society. The ethical principle might be there. But how it gets enacted and how we think of that always requires an act of reinterpretation, as well as it should.
Sam, thank you very much. We are out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but we would love to have you back next week.
That sounds wonderful, Fred. Thank you so much. I would love to be there.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today has been Professor Sam Boyd. And we have been talking about an article that he co-wrote with Samira Mehta for theconversation.com. And that article is A Justification for Unrest, Look No Further Than the Bible and the Founding Fathers. And you can still find that on theconversation.com. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU.